What's more Jewish than answering a question with a question? As Jews, we are taught to question everything around us. But we don't accept life as it is presented to us. We ask, how can we make it better? When we study Torah, we are not expected to read and accept all that the Torah says. We are supposed to question, to debate, and even argue the finer points with our study partners. In fact, when studying Rashi, one of our greatest medieval commentators, we are taught to try and decipher what's Rashi's koshi, what's Rashi's problem. In other words, most of Rashi's commentaries are structured around providing explanations to passages that he thinks might cause us to ask a question. While Jews love to argue, and I will debate anyone who disagrees with me on this, we don't simply argue for argument's sake. We question, we prod, we debate, we challenge in order to push ourselves and those around us to find deeper truths. Arguments that succeed in doing this are called arguments l'shem shemayim, arguments for the sake of heaven. Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks writes, "Is it a battle for truth or for victory? In the battle for truth, both sides win. In the battle for victory, both sides lose. The difference is not mysterious or elusive. In an argument for the sake of truth, each side is willing to listen to the views of its opponents and take them seriously. Each uses reason, logic, shared text, and a shared reverence for texts. Neither uses ad hominem arguments, abuse, contempt, or disingenuous appeals to emotion. Each is willing, if refuted, to say, 'I was wrong.' There is no triumphalism in victory, nor anger or anguish in defeat." One of the best examples of an argument l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven, are in the legal arguments between former Supreme Court justices Antonin Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. While they rarely agreed on the application of the law, they maintained an incredibly close friendship throughout their years on the bench. Justice Antonin Scalia was a loud and gregarious character who generally sided with the most conservative, right-leaning interpretation of the law. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, on the other hand, was a quiet, small, soft-spoken woman who generally sided with the most liberal interpretation of the law. While they would appear to be the unlikeliest of friends, the truth is that they and their families were lifelong friends. Scalia once said of Ginsburg, "What's not to like? Except her views of the law, of course." In describing their friendship, the Pacific Legal Foundation writes, "Despite their differences, or perhaps because of them, the pair maintained a close relationship that lasted most of their lives. They respected each other and understood that though they had different approaches, they were both dedicated to the Constitution, the court, and the country." And more than just friends, their friendship actually led to each of them being better at their job. Justice Ginsburg used to tell a story about when she was working on the majority opinion for United States versus Virginia. This was the case that stated that the university's exclusion of women violated the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection. This is what finally integrated or brought women into VMI. This case was the culmination of Ginsburg's earlier work as an advocate seeking to topple laws based on sex stereotypes that ultimately harmed women. Scalia, of course, dissented. But he shared a draft of his very spicy, according to RBG, dissent with her, a habit that went back to the days of serving on the DC Circuit Court together. In Ginsburg's recollection, seeing the weaknesses Scalia identified in her opinion allowed her to sharpen her own arguments, making the majority opinion stronger and more persuasive. Though in the years following, she used to blame Scalia for ruining her weekend. In their nearly 40 years of working together, Scalia and Ginsburg often disagreed on cases, but they knew how to debate and attack ideas rather than each other. They could vehemently disagree with the stance each of them took without necessitating demonizing the person who held the belief. The legal arguments of Justices Ginsburg and Scalia engaged in are the epitome of arguments l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven. They pushed each other in order to seek the truth. They debated ideas, not people. And their willingness to engage one another came from a place of deep respect for one another's intelligence and integrity. So when is an argument not for the sake of heaven? Well, the Mishnah tells us that the example par excellence of an argument not for the sake of heaven was the argument Korach and his followers make to Moses and Aaron, the challenge of which we read in this week's parasha. Korach challenges Moses and Aaron's leadership, saying, "You have gone too far, for all the community is holy, all of them, and Adonai is in their midst. Why do you raise yourselves above Adonai's congregation?" In response, Moses responds, "Come morning, Adonai will make known who is Adonai's and who is holy, and who will grant access to Adonai. Adonai will grant access to the one that God has chosen. Do this, you, Korach, and all your band, take your fire pans, and tomorrow put fire in them and lay incense on them before Adonai. Then the man whom Adonai chooses shall be the holy one." The next morning, Korach and his followers do as they were instructed, and the earth opens up and swallows them, their families, and all their possessions. Now, this may seem like an extreme punishment for simply asking for greater equality. After all, we read in Leviticus, "You shall be holy, for I, Adonai, your God, am holy." So what is so wrong with Korach asking Moses and Aaron to hold themselves equal with everybody else? What's so wrong with Korach trying to institute more of a democracy in the desert? Isn't that something we should applaud? Here, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks again explains. It was not that Korach and his followers wanted a community without leaders. Rather, it is that they wanted to be the leaders. The rebels' rhetoric had nothing to do with the pursuit of truth and everything to do with the pursuit of honor, status, and power. They wanted not to learn, but to win. They sought not verity, but victory. In other words, the answer lies not in the action itself, but in the intention behind the action. For if Korach's question was truly in the spirit of increasing democracy and holiness of the average Israelite, then his plea would have received a much more positive response by God. But alas, a kinder, more gentle, more holy state is not what Korach and his men were searching for. Rather, their question was aimed at creating chaos. In asking the question, Korach's intention was to divide the community and question Moses' leadership. He sought to cast doubt on the authority of God and the validity of Moses and Aaron as its leaders and increase his own power and status. And he used the people's holiness as his ploy. The intention and not the act itself is what prompted such a quick and decisive response to his challenge and to the labeling of this argument as the case extraordinaire of an argument not for the sake of heaven. In challenging Moses and Aaron, Korach was not asking an innocent question, hoping to receive a heartfelt answer. Rather, he was presenting his direct challenge in the form of an innocent question. His intention was not to find out more about the situation and to better understand the leadership motivations of Moses and Aaron, but rather to try and expose them as egotistical fools. Unfortunately, it seems that most of our arguments in the public sphere these days are not for the sake of heaven. The opposing sides don't want to talk to each other, much less learn from each other. They state their argument in an effort to completely destroy and discredit their opponents. What we have lost in the past 20 years is the ability to see the humanity of the people on the other side. Our public discourses no longer resembles Justice Ginsburg and Scalia, but rather Korach and Moses. So how do we begin to shift the discourse around us? Sometimes it's just by thinking about the message we are putting out and receiving. When we disagree with an argument, we need to be sure to respond to the argument, not the person who made it. This is something Justice Ginsburg and Scalia mastered. They could attack and refute one another's ideas and arguments without attacking the other's character and motivations. Consider this. Shortly after Justice Ginsburg's death on Erev Rosh Hashanah 2020, one of Justice Scalia's former law clerks, Judge Jeffrey Sutton, recalled this story. During one of my last visits with Justice Scalia, I saw striking evidence of the Scalia-Ginsburg relationship. As I got up to leave his chambers, he pointed to 24 roses on the table and noted that he needed to take them down to Ruth for her birthday. "Wow," I said. "I doubt I've given a total of 24 roses to my wife in over 30 years of marriage." "You ought to try it sometime," he retorted. Unwilling to give Justice Scalia the last word, I pushed back. "So what good have all those roses done for you? Name one 5-4 case of any significance where you got Justice Ginsburg's vote." Justice Scalia looked at him and said, "Some things are more important than votes." As Jews, we should never stop questioning, challenging, and calling out injustice wherever we see it. But our challenge should be in the pursuit of truth, not triumph. We should aspire to be more like Justices Ginsburg and Scalia than Korach and his followers. Shabbat Shalom.